You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone.
Or good morning if you're listening to our rebroadcast on Monday morning. Writers' Voices broadcasts at 1 p.m. Central Time Friday on KRUU 100.1 FM in Fairfield and 8 a.m. Monday morning. And it's also available at writersvoices.com. So who do we have with us today?
Today we have Melissa de la Cruz and a most interesting book, historical novel, which I love. And is the number one New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, and Publishers Weekly, internationally best-selling author. It's a mouthful. Of many critically acclaimed novels, including The Isle of the Lost, a Descendants novel, and the Summer on the East End series. Her Blue Blood series has sold over 3 million copies, and the Witches of East End series became an hour-long television drama on the Lifetime Network. So she is, you know, I mean, it's
and
everything.
The book that we're talking about today is Alex and Eliza, A Love Story. Welcome, Melissa.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. See, my publicist sent the full bio.
Yep, it looks like it. So you're a young adult novelist.
Uh-huh.
And how long have you been doing that?
I've been in publishing for almost 20 years now.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And it sounds like you're quite prolific. That you've how many published novels do you have?
I think Alex and Eliza is my 42nd.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I feel a little older than the book count.
Whoa. Okay, that's really impressive because that means that you do more than one book a year.
Yeah, I write for kids and teens, and so I wrote a lot of series books, and some of those series came out twice a year, so that's why.
Wow.
It's so high.
When do you sleep?
I don't watch TV. Everybody always asks me, how do you do it? And I'm like, well, I don't watch TV.
That'll do
don't
it.
Don't watch TV. You have a lot of time on your hands.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But this must be your full-time job, obviously.
Yeah, I've been writing full-time for 20 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
And still come up with ideas. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. So let's talk about Alex and Eliza. I understand that the musical Hamilton was the original inspiration, which makes a lot of sense. Why do you think Alexander Hamilton has become such a popular figure in our culture today?
You know, I mean, definitely the Chernow biography was, you know, a bestseller as well. So there was interest in that. And then with Hamilton, you know, the story got even, reached an even broader audience. But I think, you know, even before the Chernow and Hamilton, when I was a student at Columbia, where Alexander Hamilton went, you know, we learned about him, you know, because he was an alum just like us. And his story is so American. It's just a classic American story. He was an immigrant, you know, came from nowhere, you know, penniless, nameless, and made a name for himself here, you know, really kind of embodied the American dream. And I think that's why his story really resonates, because it's just, you know, he defines American, you know, and he founded the country. So a lot of the values that we have and the government that we have are because of him. And his own story is just, you know, a story of, you know, it's my story. I'm an immigrant. I came here, you know, my family wanted a better life. And, you know, if you had told me growing up in the Philippines that I would one day become a best-selling American novelist, you know, I'd be like, that's a fantasy. Like, that doesn't happen to people, you know, but it does, and it happens here. So I think that's why people really relate to his story.
Now, Alex and Eliza is a historical romance, and it's written for young adults. How historically accurate is it, and how much research did you have to do?
You know, I did a lot of research. I wanted to write a historical romance. It was one of the kinds of genres of books that I'd been meaning to write. I think I would tell my agent every year, I want to write a historical romance. And I never had the time for it. And then my daughter, who we took to see Hamilton with us, was obsessed with Elizabeth Schuyler. And she just wanted to know all about her. And she would say stuff like, it should have been called Eliza, because if it wasn't for Eliza, we wouldn't know about his story. And so I, you know, wanted to answer her questions. She would ask about what was true, what wasn't. And as I did the research, and I had two research assistants helping me also, one of whom was an American history professor, I wanted to write about their domestic life. I didn't want to write about just the war and the big kind of things that were happening. I read a lot of biographies of women from the time period, American women during the Revolutionary era. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to really know what, you know, what were the dances like? What did they eat at the balls? What did they serve? What did the dresses look like? What was the fashion? You know, because that was what I was interested in. And there was enough from, you know, the letters and the archives and from time period, so I could tell, you know, a pretty truthful story, but I definitely had to take some liberties because, you know, not that much is known about their love story, except that it was very whirlwind. You know, they fell in love, you know, pretty quickly, and they got married 6 months later. And, you know, it's you want to write a novel with a little drama, so I had to create some conflict.
Ah, well, there was a lot of conflict in there.
Yes.
There was a lot. And I think, you know.
I thought it would be fun if she had another suitor. And this is where the research came in, because it turned out that she had a crush on a British officer named John Andre. And so I said, well, what if, you know, her parents really wanted her to marry Major John Andre? And my research assistant said, no, they never wanted to marry a British officer. You know, you'd have to find somebody else in history to make the other suitor. So I said, all right. So I decided on Henry Livingston, who came from a very rich family, who was known to the Schuylers back then. But I don't think in real life that was ever part of the story.
Okay, so this
eyes for Alexander.
This really is a fictionalized account of their romance. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
And so the authenticity is all in the details, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, and their feelings for each other. I mean, that was pretty well accounted for in the letters and other letters from, you know, his friends talking about him being in love and that kind of stuff. So, you know, we don't really know much about her. She burned hers. So, but we know that she was devoted and she loved him very much. She died wearing a locket with the pieces of paper from a sonnet that he'd written her from the early days of their courtship. So I just thought that was so romantic.
Wow. It was a complicated society back then. Wasn't it? Much more than
it was. You know, I just thought it was so interesting because it was such a fairy tale. You know, this. You know, she's basically an American princess, and back then, all the rich American families in the colonies, you know, they all intermarried. They only married each other, like the Europeans. So her mother was a Van Rensselaer, and they were the richest family in the state. And then her father was Philip Schuyler, who was also from one of the oldest and most prestigious families. So it was. You know, she had, like, you know, the bloodline, you know, of American royalty, basically. And for her to marry somebody who didn't come from that world, you know, I just found so fascinating, you know. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting, because I always thought, like, you know, maybe it would be her parents wouldn't want her to marry him. He was no one. But, in fact, her father really was so fond of Alexander Hamilton and thought he was so brilliant and such a star and would be one of these people who would shape the country, that Philip Schuyler actually thought that it was a compliment that Alexander was marrying into their family. So I thought that was really interesting and a good twist.
Okay, wow. Was the part about her father and Washington and the trial and all that, was that authentic?
Yes.
The court martial?
That was all. That was all in the research, yep.
Yeah, I'm very curious about that because you know, to give the listeners a little bit of background, Elizabeth's father was a general, mm-hmm. and he was the general at starts with a T.
Ticonderoga.
Ticonderoga.
Yep.
Yeah, and where the British ended up winning, but the revolutionary soldiers were fighting against tremendous odds there, and actually conducted themselves very well, given the odds. And General Schuyler wasn't even there at the time, but they were under his command. And so he was court-martialed, kind of, and, you know, in your book, in Alex and Eliza, the implication is that it was a political thing, that it, that Washington really didn't want to court-martial him. So I'm curious about how you found out about that, and what the actual, you know, were you taking any liberties with that, or was that all factually based?
I took a few liberties. I don't think Alexander Hamilton delivered the papers. The night of the ball. So that was all kind of embellished. So I took, like, you know, the facts about the court-martial and the facts about the battle, and then I knew that Alexander and Elizabeth had met at a ball in 1777, so I happened during that time. So it's kind of like she doesn't like him because he's the bearer of bad news, you know. So the underlying history is real, but some of the details of how the news is presented was fiction.
Well, I wondered how you'd found out all of that.
But what I wonder is, you know, where he confronts those three redcoats and is able to subdue them, and then finds those papers.
That's also a fictionalization.
That's fictional.
I just thought that
okay,
would be fun.
Okay.
You know, it would show him as a, you know, a real hero. I mean, I didn't even really need to. He is a real hero. He was a soldier, you know, a very brave soldier. But I thought it would be fun to add the Benedict Arnold layer.
Okay.
Oh, definitely. The mom was pointing out to me, of course, that Hamilton is on the $10 bill. And the man on the $10 bill is extremely handsome. Is that really what he looked like?
Yeah, no. Apparently, he was quite the fox. he was very popular with the ladies, and he was a ladies' man, and he was very charming. You know, a big flirt, and liked the company of people. You know, very charismatic. Yeah, no. Apparently, he was very, very handsome. So. So I thought that was a fun thing, too.
But
he was handsome and dashing, you know, and when I did a lot of the research, that's when I thought, oh, my God, this would be a perfect young adult novel, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Who doesn't love a handsome soldier as a hero?
Yeah, but for the wealthy families and of that time, he was not acceptable because he didn't have wealth. He didn't have a family.
Exactly. He was nobody.
Yeah.
You know, he was just himself. He only had himself to fall back on.
Yeah.
Now, you have Eliza's two sisters are also prominent characters in the book, and you have them paired off romantically as well. And how were you able to find out much about them, or did you have to make most of that up?
You know, again, a lot of the facts are the facts. You know, John Church, who married Angelica Schuyler, was a very rich man, and he was a gun runner. He was a British officer, but helping the American cause. So so there was kind of like the shady, you know, but because, you know, he was kind of treasonous to his own kind, you know, people, he had like different names, and there was like kind of a shady kind of a fog around his finances. So there was a little bit of like, where does he get his money, you know, and then you find out later, oh, he's a patriot. A lot of the archives and a lot of the research on their marriage, you know, she definitely married him for his money, and he was rich, and he could give her the life that she was used to, and, you know, and she was a very, much more sophisticated, much more European in outlook than Eliza. You know, she was kind of the darling of European drawing rooms, you know, this kind of muse to Thomas Jefferson, to Benjamin Franklin, you know, this kind of fashion-y, kind of really smart, you know, kind of woman, you know, who was very worldly. And she was just such a contrast to Eliza, who a lot of the research and history, you know, showed to be like much more simple in nature, very sensible, and very American, you know, kind of in her outlook, you know, not so European. So I really was drawn to Eliza. But, you know, and I love Angelica, too, you know, but she made her different choices in her life. So I tried to extrapolate from the facts, you know, something kind of interesting. And, you know, why would she marry somebody who was much older and not very attractive? You know, and Angelica says, you know, it's much better to be with somebody who worships you. You know, she liked the worship.
And what about Peggy?
Yeah, and then Peggy, you know, married in one of the richest man in New York. She married Stephen Van Rensselaer, and not a lot is known about him or their marriage. She died young, sadly. So a lot of the personalities of John Church and Stephen are fictional in the book. I just kind of made them up.
Right. Now, the book covers the period of time from when they meet, mm-hmm. first meet, and of course they don't start courting right away.
Nope.
So, and then you kind of, and it goes through their marriage, but you don't go past that. I'm just wondering, you know, as a writer, why did you make the choice to cover that time period?
A little bit of the constraints of the genre. I write for teenagers, and it's a young adult genre, and I wanted to end with their wedding. You know, it seemed like a fun place to end the story. You know, it's a story of them being young, of them finding themselves, you know, discovering who they are, what they want in life, which is, you know, the classic YA theme. It was just seemed natural, you know, because the young adult genre is not about adults. It's about, you know, kids and young people kind of finding their way in the world. So that seems like a natural point to end the story.
I'm curious if you've ever thought about writing for adults.
I have written for adults.
You have?
I have my Witches of East End series, which is an adult fantasy.
Ah, okay. And do you have any issues with, like, your young adult fans wanting to read then books that aren't appropriate for them?
You know, I really think at 11, at 13, I mean, at 13 and at 11, I was reading Stephen King.
This
whole young adult genre is almost like kind of maybe a new thing because, once you can read and comprehend stories, you know, you kind of just read anything.
That is true.
So I don't really have... I don't know. I don't really see it that way. I mean, when a 9-year-old asks if she can read Witches of East End, I'm kind of like, oh, ask your mom. I grew up reading whatever I wanted, and my mom, you know, kind of they didn't put a lot of restrictions on my reading. You know, they kind of thought, well, she's reading, can't be that bad.
Well, what is different
once in a while? What are you reading?
Yeah, as a writer, what is? How do you write differently then for young adults and adults?
And I don't think you really do. I'm just a writer. You know, they market them to whatever. I mean, my young adult books in Europe, there's no such thing as a young adult market. They're just books, and they're just published as, you know, normal.
As books.
In the normal adult category. So that's also an American marketing phenomenon. But I do think, because I do specialize in writing for kids and teenagers, and a lot of the writers that I know are in the same industry, and we write for kids, is that, you know, we like to write, I mean, it's all about kind of youthful optimism and idealism, and I think that's why the young adult market has grown so much now. You know, they're really about, you know, how the novelty of life and how all the opportunities are open, you know, when you're 16, 15, 17, you can be anybody, you can do anything, and everything is new, and everything, you feel everything so much, like first love, first kisses, you know, first heartbreak, you know, and it just, you know, I think they say there's like a mental age where you stay at, and I think I've definitely stayed 14 my entire life, so I really understand what, you know, being a teenager is like, I don't know, but I read widely. I read both in and out of the genre, and I read middle grade. I read picture books. I read young adults. I read all sorts of adult books. So.
Now, do you write with your own daughter in mind?
Do I write with my daughter in mind?
Yeah, with your daughter in mind. Do you write for
no.
your... No?
No? You know, I really write for myself. I write to entertain myself, you know, and I think that's what writers really do, is that, you know, you spend so much time alone in that world with your characters, so, you know, really, you're kind of just entertaining and pleasing yourself, and I don't really think about other people reading it until other people do, you know, and then my editor will chime in, you know, with something, but usually it's like we just try to tell the best story we can, you know. I think maybe twice in my career I've been asked to change something because they felt that maybe not so appropriate for the genre. I think I had one of the vampires, I wrote a big vampire series, and one of the vampire girls who was 15, she was a New Yorker, and I covered the kind of glittery scene in New York as a fashion reporter, and I would go to these parties and see these teenagers, and they had these boyfriends, you know, in their 40s. And so I had my character, who was 15, but a centuries-old vampire, have a 40-year-old boyfriend, and my editor said, can he be 21? Can he not be 40? So I changed it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Melissa De La Cruz, author of Alex and Eliza, A Love Story, which is for fans of Hamilton. It's a good way to keep the groove going.
Right.
How many times have you seen Hamilton, Melissa?
Oh, my God. Tickets are impossible. We saw it once. We're going to see it again, and we're seeing it in L.A.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, tickets are impossible. I've been trying for a year to get tickets. When they release a new block, they're sold out before you can even hit the key on the computer.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
It really is.
It is. And when you saw it, was it with the original cast?
Yes, it was. It was wonderful. It was an amazing experience. It was the week after it had won all the Tonys.
Wow.
Huge. You know, it was just, the applause was deafening, but also just the electricity in the room. And, you know, I just watched, didn't think I was going to write a book about Alex and Eliza. I just watched it as a fan. And it was so profound to see it, you know, as a immigrant, as a person of color in America, to see brown, Asian, black people playing the founding fathers. After the show, we went back to our hotel, and I sobbed for half an hour. I was just so moved by the experience. It was very profound. And then it was only weeks later when my daughter kept talking about Eliza. I was like, oh, maybe I'll write a book.
Melissa, do you try to feature people of color and immigrants as characters in your other books?
Yes. I just wrote a book called Something in Between, which is about a Filipino teenager who is a academic scholar, valedictorian, head cheerleader, just does everything right to go to the right college. And she discovers her parents confess to her that they're actually in America illegally, and they're undocumented. So the story is about what happens next, you know, what happens to the family, what does she do about this predicament. So it's about immigration and about something that, you know, kind of become a big issue now also
in
the United States.
You know, we're doing an interview in a couple of weeks with Daniel Connolly, who with the Book of Isaiah, which is a nonfiction book about that very same thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a hard book.
I bet. Do you, I mean, with 42 books, can you even remember what they all, you know, like what the plots are on all of them?
Some of them I'm a little shaky on, but I'm pretty sure I can tell you what each series is about and how it ends. You know, I might forget what happened exactly and, you know, whether it would happen in a certain book or book one or two or seven, you know, but I'll know.
How many
the big plot points.
When you start out, when you write the first book, do you always know that it's going to be a series and how many books, and do you plot it all out ahead of time?
You know, we always hope they're a series. Sometimes the publisher cancels them before you can write the whole thing. So,
wow.
But yeah, you know, I do know. I like to know where I'm going. I think that's a big important thing for writers to know. You know, you always have to know the end.
So,
and you can work your way there.
Is Alex and Eliza going to be a series too, do you think, or?
We just sold the sequel, so we announced the sequel.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Now, I think it would be really interesting, too. I mean, when you say a sequel, I'm assuming it's still about the same two, Alexander Hamilton and his wife. But wouldn't it, I think it'd be cool to expand this to other historical figures of that time period. But kind of from the same perspective, looking at from, you know, the romantic aspect. Have you ever considered that?
I was playing with a few different ideas. You know, we might do something like that, you know, and I say we, saying me and my publisher, you know, it's always an open conversation.
Right, right.
But yeah, you know, I just discovered that Thomas Jefferson had a very romantic story with his wife who died tragically, Martha Washington. I mean, Martha Jefferson, sorry. And I thought that was there was no affair.
That would be interesting. Wouldn't it? And of course, John Adams and his wife.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it would really actually be nice to have more literature out there about the impact that these women had on the founding of America.
Yes.
I agree. Yeah. And that's why I kind of focused it on Eliza, because I thought there was so much that the women brought to the table that is not as celebrated. And I think that's why Hamilton is so great, because the women are just as equal in the story.
Yeah, the founding mothers and the founding daughters.
Yeah.
And
well, it's interesting how she was sewing uniforms, you know, for so that the soldiers would have something to wear, because of course after the hard winter Washington's troops were just, you know, in rags, and so she was trying to and then what I found was interesting was her father gave that British guy that had burned his house in gave him some place to live.
and was that historically accurate?
Yes, that was.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Totally, yeah. It was interesting. It was like, it was war, but it was still kind of polite, you know?
Yeah.
It was still like that century, you know? It was,
yeah.
It was and because the winter, what I thought was so funny is like in the winter, there's no battle, you know? So they were just partying. And one of the German baron who was a part of the American cause said he'd never, and when Washington came to New Jersey, you know, he just said, I'd never seen such a debauched, you know, playground. It was just people having balls and soirees and sleigh rides and, you know, just all the social milieu in the middle of this huge war. So I thought that was funny.
But then didn't Washington, like, sneak up on the British in the winter, crossing the river, Delaware River?
Delaware?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a famous.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody expected them.
That's right.
Nobody expected them to do that.
That's right.
Wow. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the rules of engagement were and how they have changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, Melissa, it's been really interesting talking with you today. Normally we ask, we ask our writers how they got the book published, but with your publishing history, I'm guessing that wasn't a problem for you.
I guess not.
Yeah, no, just send an email.
But when you were starting out, do you have, you know, how did you get your first book published?
I graduated from college. I wanted to be a writer, but there was you know, how does that happen? Like, it just felt so mysterious and close, you know. And but I was determined to do it, and I was at the bookstore, and there was a book called The Writer's Market, and it was talked about how to get published, and it listed all the agents who represented writers, and it listed all the publishers, and it said, you know, if you really want to be taken seriously, you should get an agent first. So I thought, well, I can follow directions, so that's what I did. I just followed directions from the book, and I sent it to about 25 agents. I sent 5 chapters. You know, they say you have to send 5 chapters and a cover letter. And please send the first 5. Don't send chapter 1, chapter 10, chapter 20. You know, we want to see if you can build the story. So I sent it to the 25 agents. And of the 25 agents, 6 of them wrote back and said they wanted to represent me.
Wow, that's pretty good. Pretty good result. Yeah.
And so I sent it back to the 6 agents. They said they wanted to read the whole book. And I said, oh, no, now I have to write the whole book. I hadn't written the book yet. I didn't want to write it unless somebody wanted it. And of the 6 agents, 3 of them said, we want to take this book out. And I went with, you know, one of the more senior agents on the list. And he actually wasn't even, we actually weren't even able to sell that novel. But he did get me a meeting with an editor, Simon Schuster, who was interested in my writing and said, you know what, this is probably not the novel you're going to sell, and I'm not buying it. It's too raw. It's not a novel. But he said, I want you to write for magazines and newspapers and get, you know, professional credits. And then once you have a clip file, and, you know, keep writing, write another novel. So I wrote another novel, and I wrote for magazines. And then a couple of years later, he bought my first novel, Cast Me Out. Simon Schuster published it. So it took about 5 years from getting that first initial agent to publication.
So when you were first telling the story, it sounded like, wow, that was easy, but it wasn't quite as easy as it sounds, was it?
I think it's, but, you know, I think all that encouragement, you know, from people saying they wanted to see more of the writing and from getting my first agent, from meeting this publisher, and then meeting more people in the industry, you know, and I couldn't sell my second novel. You know, 2 years later, tried to sell the second novel, got a whole bunch of rejections. Tried to sell a nonfiction book of essays because I was writing for the New York Press at the time. We didn't sell that either.
Wow.
So I was getting a little discouraged. And then finally, I put together this other novel, but I really was like, you know, I really thought to myself, if this doesn't sell, maybe it's a sign that this is not going to happen for me and I should do something else. But then my agent sold it in a week. So it was like, oh my God. It was easy again.
Wow.
It took a while.
Well, congratulations. And we definitely enjoyed Alex and Eliza.
Yes.
And Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
I do. This fits our guest perfectly. Not all of your dreams will come true, but that is no reason not to pursue them.
That's right.
All right.
Definitely.
And thank you, Melissa De La Cruz, Alex and Eliza, available wherever books are sold. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Thanks so much.